العليم من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبه نستعين لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله والصلاة والسلام على خير خلقه ونور العرش أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين خاتم النبيين شفيع المذنبين رحمة للعالمين سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا والشفيع نفوسنا والطبيب ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد
اللهم صل على محمد
ثم الصلاة والسلام على أهل البيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين المتجبين المكرمين الخيرين الفاضلين ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين من الأولين والآخرين إلا قيام يوم الدين أما بعد فقد قال الله سبحانه وتبارك وتعالى في كتابه المبين بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ومن الناس من يقول آمنا بالله ويوم الآخر وما هم بمؤمنين صدق الله العلي العظيم وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين صلوات
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
We begin in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the Kind, the Compassionate. All praise, all thanks, and all glory is for Him and for Him alone. To all my brothers and sisters in Islam and Iman, Salaam alaikum, Jamian wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We should first start out by sending our condolences to the Imam of the time, Bibi Fatima alayhi salam, to the Prophet on the beginning of the month of Muharram, on the day where we come together to commemorate the tragedy of Karbala. So let us extend our condolences to them and to you, Abdullahu, Wajuruna Wajurukum. And let's let them know that we are there with them in heart and in spirit with a loud salawat. So I wanted to thank you all for the kind invitation to be able to speak for the first 10 days of Muharram. Inshallah, hopefully this will be an experience where all of us can learn. Not just you, but myself as well. Because I'm just a student myself. So while we're going to be together for the next 12 nights, let's try to keep an open relationship. What I mean is that there's going to be certain things during the speech that maybe I don't express clearly. You know, maybe you won't understand. So, if that's the case, come to me afterwards and let me know. And I'll try my best to explain it, inshallah. And if there's something that was maybe too complicated or wasn't explained well enough, then again, we can discuss that later after the majlis. So, I'm here basically at your service. I'm just doing my level of ibadat and offering whatever I can to the Imam of the time and to Bibi Fatima alayhi salam as, you know, a type of mourning, a type of grief that we can offer. So, one piece of advice before we begin the program is about the etiquette that we should have when we're in majlis. The etiquette, the behavior, the manners that we should, you know, how should we behave when we're in a gathering like this? So, we need to keep in mind that although we're here, sometimes we're kind of brought here by our parents, we really don't have a choice, but you're still going to get blessings no matter what. With us right now, Bibi Fatima alayhi salam is here, the Imam of the time is here. There's angels who are sitting around us, who are giving us blessings and taking these blessings back to Allah, and letting Him know that we're here to share in the grief. So what we should keep in mind also is, if we're those who say that we're Shia, Shia of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, then when we come to any gathering, but especially a majlis where there's going to be some knowledge, we should be in a mode where we're all students. And what do I mean by that? Well, one time, there was a person who lived around the time of the sixth Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, alayhi salam. And so at that time, many of you know, the sixth Imam was teaching hundreds and hundreds of students. So this person realized he was a Shia himself. And he knew that the Imam taught special clothes, smaller closed classes for his Shia only. Because the Imam taught everybody no matter what they were. If they're Christian, atheist, Sunni, didn't matter. He would teach them regardless. But for that special nur, that special ilm, the special knowledge, he would only give it to his Shia, his close Shia. So when this person found out, he went to the Imam and he said, I want to attend your special classes. And he said, no, you don't want to have any part of this, it's not for you. He said, no, I'm one of your Shia, I want to be a part of this, I want that extra knowledge. So he said, okay, come to me tomorrow and be at this place at this time. So the person was very, very excited. So he came the next day, he joined the class and he sat down, and the Imam began, and as he was looking around, he stopped at that person who was sitting in the gathering, and he asked this companion, this Shia, so-called Shia, he said, where's your pen and paper? And the person looked up and said, I don't have one. And he said, but you said yesterday that you are my Shia. My Shia are always with the pen and paper. So what the Imam was trying to teach this, and to all of us as well, is that we should always be in a position where we carry a pen and paper, so that we can take notes on things that we haven't heard before. Or if we hear something that we have a question about, we can write that down and ask about it later. So especially for the ones who are a little bit younger here, who might not have heard all of these things before. There's going to be certain things that I'm going to be explaining, inshallah, that might be a little unclear. They might be a little bit too complex. So if that's the case, write that down. So tomorrow, inshallah, everybody should bring a pen and a paper if they can. And write down any comments, any suggestions, any questions, any problems that they have. And then afterwards, you can either, you know, bring them to me or bring them to your parents, and we can, inshallah, try to figure that out. Also, the majlis, the style of the majlis, if any of you are used to it, is typically there's some sort of advice given at the beginning, then we go on to the history, and then it moves on to the maqal, the masa'if, the tragedy part. So we're going to try to keep that going, but again, since there's a lot of youth here, we're going to cut it down in certain parts, and we're going to extend other parts as well. So it's not going to follow the exact format that some of you might be used to, but inshallah, we'll try our best. We're also going to try to include some ahkam, some laws that maybe some of us aren't aware of. Because as we're here, we need to make sure that if we're here as Shia of Ahlul Bayt, we need to be practicing the laws that a Shia should be practicing. So if there's any issues that anyone has, maybe they don't understand something about namaz or salat, maybe they have some questions about fasting, maybe they have some questions about any issue, write them down, you know, we can bring it to us afterwards and we'll try to address them the next day in the next majlis, inshallah. So with that, we're going to begin the lecture. If you can send a loud salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
So, again, Shia of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasalam, we're here again. Another Muharram has passed, or is beginning. And we're here every year, no matter what. No matter what kind of Shia we are, we're always here to commemorate Ashura, to commemorate the tragedy of Karbala. Even those people who don't come in the month of Ramadan, they don't go on Hajj, they don't pray, they don't fast, they don't do anything else, no matter what, you'll see every Shia turn out in the month of Muharram. Even if they don't come the first 8 days or 9 days, they'll be there on Ashura no matter what. Now you might say, well, they're just doing it so that they can show everybody else in the community that, look, I'm showing up too. But regardless, there's still an attractive power that Muharram has. There's a power that we have in the month of Muharram that Abu Abdullah brings, that all the Shia gather together. I mean, it's not just coincidence that more people visit the Imam at Karbala than they do in Hajj. Millions and millions and millions of people turn up on Arba'in, on Ashura. More people than are on Hajj. So there's a power that's there that we need to figure out where that came from. So what we're used to is, we come every year, you know, we recite poetry, we dress in black, we shed tears, we go over that same history that we've always heard. And sometimes we get something out of it and sometimes we don't. So we need to figure out what was the purpose for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, what was the purpose of his revolution? Why did he go out? Why did he take 72 companions? Why did he take children? Why did he take women? Why did he go with all these people to Karbala with knowledge that all of them would be martyred? All of them would be shaheed. There's a specific reason he went and performed this action, this ibadah, this high level of ibadah. And we need to reflect and think, is it just so that we can come together and cry? Or is there something else behind that? Because if it was just for tears, then we'd be doing our mission every year, and we'd be crying, but we'd never be changing. Nothing else would ever happen. So there has to be something more that we have to get out of this. So first, I want to share with you a narration that comes from the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
So the Prophet told us that regarding the killing of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the killing of Hussein has left in the qalb al-mu'min, in the heart of a faithful person, a heat, a fire that will never die. It'll never calm down and it'll never subside. So let's stop and think about this for a second. So I want to make an analogy. Right now, maybe some of you are feeling cold in this room right now. You know, the door is right over here, the heating's not very good. So we're all probably feeling a little cold. So what do we do when we feel a little cold? We turn up the heat, right? That's the natural thing that we do. So why do we do that? Well, there's two reasons. The first reason is whenever we feel cold, you know, we don't feel right. We feel uncomfortable. So we want naturally to be at a comfortable temperature so we can all do what we were doing. So, you know, if you're too cold at work, you won't be able to work properly. You need to make sure that the heat's going so that you can do your work. If you're at school and the classroom's too cold, you won't be able to focus. And you're going to complain to the teacher, oh, it's too cold in here, I can't concentrate. If you're in your bed and you're trying to sleep and it's too cold, you won't be able to sleep either. So everybody needs that proper temperature to be able to do what they have to do. Because when it's that uncomfortable temperature, then we get cranky or we get upset, we complain, we get angry. And of course, some of us like that, but everybody has that uncomfortable temperature. So we put ourselves, or we increase the heat, or we put ourselves at a comfortable temperature so that we feel better. So that first reason that there's a heat needed when it's cold is so that we have an emotional feeling of comfortability. So now let's link this to Karbala and the tragedy. Whenever we hear something sad, like a catastrophe or a tragedy, let's say we hear about what's been happening in Somalia, or we hear about what's going on in Bahrain, or we hear about what just happened in Saudi Arabia, all these killings and murders, or we hear about poverty. Anytime this happens, there's this coldness that's in your heart. And when you have this coldness in your heart, naturally, the human instinct is to want to make yourself feel better, to be comfortable again. So how do we do that? We do that through azadari. We do that through reciting poetry. We do that through dressing in black. We do that through crying. We come to the majalis. You know, we do all these things. Matam, latmiya, all of these things. And this basically raises the temperature of our heart. That's one part of that heat that's in our heart. So naturally we're cold and we feel bad whenever we hear about what happened to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. What happened to Hazrat Abbas alayhi salam? What happened to Ali Asghar alayhi salam? What happened to the women at Sham? We feel bad. So we feel like we need to commemorate, we need to mourn, and we need to do this in whatever way we feel comfortable. But that's just one way. There's another way too. So let's go back to the first analogy. So again, let's say it's cold outside. So obviously you're going to want to bundle up to feel better, you know, so that you feel at a comfortable temperature. So the first reason we talked about is so that in our brain or in our heart that we feel good, so that we can move on and do what we were doing before. But there's another reason too, and this is typically the reason that we hear from our moms. You know, they want you to bundle up, put on your hat, put on your scarf, zip up your jacket. Why do they say that? So you don't get a cold, so you don't get sick. Because if you get sick, then there's going to be some other problems. So that other reason that somebody wants to warm up is so that Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
So the other reason that we want to heat up is so that we don't get sick. So now let's link this back to what we said about the heat or that fire that's in the heart of a mu'min when they hear about the tragedy of Karbala. So this heat is for something physically damaging to us. So what's the physical damage that we have? What kind of coldness do we have in our hearts that's physical? This coldness comes from disobeying Allah. This coldness comes when we sin. This coldness comes as a hijab in our hearts, in our souls. So the way to fix that is that heat that we're supposed to use is to use this process of azadari to reform ourselves so that we can become better Shia of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasalam. So that's something that unfortunately many of us miss out on. We get the first part, okay, you know, we come, we recite the poetry, we dress in black, we'll cry, we'll listen to the majalis. But sometimes we'll forget that we have to fix ourselves at the same time. Azah is meant to both allow us to mourn for the Imam and pay our respects to the family of the Prophet, and at the same time, in the words of the Imam, it's meant to reform us. Remember the final words of the Imam before he had left Medina. He had told his brother Muhammad ibn Hanafiyah that I didn't leave to revolt for the cause of evil or tyranny or corruption, but I left to reform my grandfather's ummah. I want to command good and forbid evil. What's that? Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahi al-Munkar. And follow the path of my father and grandfather. So what the Imam was trying to tell everybody at that time, and us in the future who are getting his message, is I didn't just go against Yazid and start a revolution just to get rid of Yazid. It's not that simple. It's because the people around that time were not practicing Muslims. Imagine the state of a nation. You know, how could we live in a Muslim empire, the people back then, where their leader, Yazid, was openly drinking, was openly cursing people. And he had said the Prophet didn't receive any message. He didn't care. He said he wasn't a Muslim. And yet Muslims still let him be the leader. This was how bad the Muslims were at that time. And still people didn't want to rise up against him. So what the Imam wanted to do is not just to get rid of Yazid, but to create an ummah that could get rid of Yazid. And this is what happened in the future, as we see, of course, because the Imam's mission was successful. So what we want to do, inshallah, in the next few nights, and this will be the main topic that we're going to go through, is to find out how can we prevent ourselves from being the Muslims who existed back then. How can we be the kind of Muslims that continue the message of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the kind of Muslims who will allow the Imam of the time to return. Now, some of you might be thinking, okay, well, we've been performing Azadari for a very long time. We've been doing it for years and years and years. And some of us have been coming to Majalis for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years even. So, if Aza and mourning and lamentation, if all of this is supposed to fix us, then how could we still be sinning? Because we have even hadith, for example, from the fifth Imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, alayhi salatu wasalam. The Imam had told us that for those who shed a tear for Imam Hussein, the size of the wing of a mosquito, that single Salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
So for those individuals, those Muslimin, those mu'mineen, who shed a tear the size of the wing of a mosquito. How big is the wing of a mosquito? That big. You shed one tear like that, that tear will be a barrier between heaven and hell for the person. Now think about that. That's very, very powerful. I mean, literally, if one person, because of his love for the Imam, sheds one single little tear, the Imam is saying that tear is enough to keep you away from hellfire. But again, we can't take these ahadith so literally. Does that mean that, okay, I shed some tears, now I can go and I can lie and I can cheat, I can steal, I can disobey my parents, I can miss namaz and salat, you know, I don't have to fast? No, no, no. There's something else behind this. And inshallah, we're going to get to that in the future speeches, inshallah. So now, remember that hadith that we quoted from the Prophet, where he said that there's a fire, there's a heat inside the heart of a mu'min. The reason that we can't change in the month of Muharram, or the reason that we find such a problem in doing so, is because of what the Prophet was saying. He didn't say that there's a heat inside the heart of a Muslim. He didn't say that there's a heat inside of the heart of a Shia. He didn't say there was a fire inside the heart of a human. But he said this was in qalbul mu'min, the heart of a mu'min. What's a mu'min? Mu'min is a person who has iman. Well, what's iman? Iman literally is just faith. But what is faith? Can any of us claim here that we have true faith, true iman? It's not something that's that simple. All of us can claim at the least that we're Muslim. Because Muslim is very simple. You say, La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There you go, you're Muslim. Anybody walking down the street, you can tell them, hey, repeat these two lines, and now they're a Muslim, legally speaking. But to be a mu'min is something else. That takes a lot more effort. So this is why I chose for the verse at the beginning that I recited. This is from Surah Al-Baqarah, and then I'm going to repeat the verse for you. It's Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَقُولُ آمَنَّا بِاللَّهِ وَيَوْمِ الْآخِرِ وَمَا هُمْ بِمُؤْمِنِينَ. So what's the translation? وَمِنَ النَّاسِ, from people, there's people that مَنْ يَقُولُ, that they say آمَنَّا بِاللَّهِ وَيَوْمِ الْآخِرِ. we believe in Allah and we believe in the last day, the day of judgment. And then Allah continues and says, وَمَا هُمْ بِمُؤْمِنِينَ, but they're not mu'mineen. So he's saying, there's people who say with their tongues, we believe in God, we believe in the last day. And Allah says, but you're not mu'mineen. So your tongue doesn't make you a mu'min. It's something else. Something else has to give you iman. So how can we get iman? And it's for this reason that the series of Majalis for the next 12 nights, we've entitled From Muslim to Mu'min. Because that's what we have to figure out how to become. Because if we can become mu'mineen, then we can figure out how can we use the azadari, this powerful energy of Muharram, to transform ourselves, to stop disobeying Allah, and to be Shia, true Shia of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now there's a lot of different ways that we could approach this. I mean, if you look and do research about what have the prophets and what have the imams said about how to get iman, there's countless amounts of ahadith. So we have to try to figure out, you know, the base angle to start out with. So I found one hadith that I think will be pretty good for us to start and to make as the basis for our lectures, inshallah. And this comes from the first imam, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salatu wa salam.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
Please recite one more loud salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
So what does the imam tell us? He says, afdalu iman husnu iqan. Afdalu iman is what? The best of iman, the best of faith is in what? Husnu iqan. Husn means good or excellent. Iqan is another form of the word yaqeen. So he's saying that the best of iman, the best of faith, comes from excellent yaqeen. So now we got to figure out, what is yaqeen? Literally, it just means certitude or certainty, being sure of something. So before we try to get an understanding of what yaqeen is, I want to ask everybody here a couple of questions. Does anybody know what happened yesterday? What day was yesterday? You guys don't know what yesterday was?
Friday.
But what kind of Friday was it?
Yes.
Black Friday, right? What's Black Friday? Black Friday is the day, the name of the day we give, where the West gives, for this day where people go out shopping. It's the first official day of the Christmas shopping season, right? So there's all these crazy deals, all these sales, all these specials. Stores will open at midnight or 6 a.m. and they'll have these doorbuster deals. It'll be crazy. People will camp out all night, all around the store, just to get these whatever deals. So, how many of you went out and bought something? MashaAllah, very good. So, did everybody find a good deal?
Yeah.
Of course, why else would you go out if you wouldn't? So, yes.
Is it Friday a celebration? Every Friday?
Yes, that's right. Every Friday is Eve, very good. We'll do questions afterwards, inshallah, don't worry. So, but he's right, every Friday is Eid, except for Black Friday, which is not necessarily a good day. So, why did people go out on Black Friday to buy these things? Well, because they saw a deal in the paper, or online, or they heard about it from somewhere. So, let me give you a hypothetical situation. Let's say we started this program on Thursday, and I told you guys, listen, I read in the paper, or I saw online, there's some deal at whatever, Best Buy, Target, Walmart, wherever. And this deal was, for the first 1,000 people in line, if you're there at opening, let's say they open at 6 a.m., if you're one of the first 1,000 people in line, you get your choice of either an iPad 2, a PS3, an Xbox 360, a 60-inch plasma TV, or a $1,000 gift card. As soon as you walk in, one of these things is free of charge. You just get. How many of you would wait in line for that? Yeah, that's what I thought. Who wouldn't? But why would we do that? Obviously, we love things, right? We like electronics. We like all this stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that, really. Now, the reason that we went is for two reasons. One is, again, we like stuff. We like rewards. But the other reason is that we have this kind of trust in what the company is telling us. If we see an ad, whether it's in the paper or it's online, or we ask somebody in the store, if we ask them and say, listen, is this deal for real? Like, you're really going to give away this stuff if we're the first, you know, one of the first 1,000 people? If they say yes, then are you going to be like, well, no, I don't believe you? If somebody from the store says it, or if it's in the paper, in some sort of advertisement, you're going to take their word, and you're going to go ahead and wait for it. So there's two parts of that. There's the reward, plus that faith that you have in it. That faith that you have is the yaqeen. That certainty that if I do such and such action, if I do this thing, if I struggle a little bit, I'm going to get some reward. So now, let's think about this. How many of us do the same thing when Allah says, wake up for Fajr, and I'll give you paradise, and I'll give you unlimited rewards? Do we have that same type of yaqeen? How many more people are in line for Black Friday for a deal, and how many people are in line waking up for Fajr, or Salatul Layl? I'm not asking you to raise your hands because, you know, everyone can answer for themselves. But this is what I mean. There's a distinction. We have a trust in what Best Buy tells us, and what Walmart tells us. We're willing to wake up or stay up all night and wait in the freezing cold just to get a TV or a gift card or an iPad, whatever. But when Allah says, I'll give you an eternity of paradise, I'll give you whatever you want after you pass away, if you just do these few simple actions, just pray on time, you know, fast in the month of Ramadan, don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, simple things. But for some reason we find it difficult to do that. So the problem here is yaqeen. The problem is that if we really understood La ilaha illallah, if we understood Muhammadur Rasulullah, then what person wouldn't wake up before Fajr to get those rewards? Because anybody here who wakes up on time for Fajr, or for example, wakes up for Salatul Layl, Namaz al-Shab even, anybody here who's done it, you know, you can ask around, they know what the rewards are for that. And the rewards are, it's not simple, it's not a, you know, it's not the equivalent of a TV, it's even better than that. Because the TV will break, you got to get it replaced, you'll have to get a new one. But the rewards that you get that Allah provides for doing His ibadah, doing worship for Him, is much, much different. And He gives you rewards in this world plus the next world. You can't take your 60-inch TV with you when you die. You can't take that with you to your grave. You can't take your PS3. That stuff's not going to help you out. So what our job is then for the next 12 nights is to figure out, how can we become those who have yaqeen? That yaqeen which will give us iman, the kind of iman that will make us more certain and act to get the rewards that Allah has promised us, rather than the rewards that, you know, some guy at Best Buy promises us. So that will be our job, inshallah. So let's tie this in with what we had said before. So we really have to figure out. We all say that, okay, I believe that there's one God, I believe He's good, He's just, there's prophets, there's imams, there's a Quran that's, you know, completely, you know, the word of God. There's shaitan who comes and whispers to me. There's angels, there's jinn. We say all these things, and we learn them in our madrasas or Sunday or Saturday schools. But how many of us actually believe in all this? If somebody came up to you, for example, and said, let's say he was a friend that didn't believe in God or didn't believe in Shia Islam, and they came up to you and said, you know, what's your view about God? Do you believe in Him? And what do we all say? Yeah, of course I believe in God. And then if we asked him, and then he would ask us, you know, why do you believe in God? What answer would we be able to give him? Most of us, unfortunately, won't have an answer. We'll just say, I just feel Him in my heart. And those kind of answers don't work. Because that means that with our own self, we can't answer to ourselves. Because true iman means that you can explain it to yourself, plus you can explain it to somebody else. They say true knowledge comes when you're able to teach it back to other individuals. So if we can't explain our beliefs to anybody else, then how do we expect to act on them ourselves? It's something that's, you know, we need to figure out and make that link. So imagine, for example, I want to stretch this point out. Let's send a salawat first.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
So I think that maybe we don't understand what this point was about, you know, not being able to say what we believe in. So I want you to think about, you know, sometimes the adults or young adults will be, you know, there'll be a kid with a group of adults. So the adults will make some sort of joke, or they'll make a comment, or they'll say a word, or they'll have a phrase that obviously a kid couldn't understand. So the kid, when he hears this and he sees the other adults laughing about it, he'll look at their face and he'll start laughing too, right? That's what kids do. They look at it and they mimic. So when a kid sees this, and then the adults look at him, they say, what are you laughing at? You don't know what we're talking about. So what answer does he give? Yeah, I know what you're talking about. So then we ask him, okay, what is so-and-so, what does this word mean? I don't know, but I mean, I know, but I'm not going to tell you. So that's kind of the answer we give to people sometimes. You know, oh, you believe in an imam that's been alive for hundreds and hundreds of years and this is hiding somewhere? Yeah, I believe, but I can't tell you. So if we don't expect that answer to work for other people, we can't have that kind of answer for ourselves. So we need to have a more academic answer. So to get that, we're going to try in the next 12 nights to go through every single one of the usul al-deen. Tawheed, adal, nabuwat, imamat, qiyamat. We're going to try and break these down and see if we can go through logical proofs. So that if somebody comes up to us and says, prove to me God exists. Okay, here's the proofs. Prove to me God's just. Alright, here's the proof. Prove to me that there's prophets. Alright, here's the proof. We're going to go through each and every one of these things. And again, like I mentioned in the beginning, if there's any points that aren't addressed, make a note of them. You know, write them down. And then come to me or your parents and they can tell me. And we'll try to make a note of them and address them tomorrow or the next night, inshallah. So, again, like I had said, we wanted to break down the lecture in a few different parts. So, the main series is going to be regarding this topic of from Muslim to Mu'min. And in the beginning, we're going to be going through this topic, and every night, try to hit a different point and try to prove that it's not just something that we have to believe in. It's something that's logically provable. And we all can tell somebody else this is how we come to our beliefs. But again, there's other parts as well. We're going to get into the history, inshallah. As far as ahkam and laws are concerned, we'll probably start that tomorrow. So if anybody has any questions tonight, you can come afterwards, let me know if there's any issues, and we'll try to address those tomorrow, inshallah. And of course, we'll end up with a short masayib. Not very long, but you know, very, very short masayib. So, do you know if the...
I think that's still going on.
Still going on, inshallah. Okay, somebody could let me know when they're getting close, inshallah. Please send one last salawat. So what we want to try to do is, because I know it'll be good for all of us if we can all go for the Nauhe, the Latmiyah together in the main hall. So I want to try, inshallah, with the help of Allah, to time everything so that we finish around the same time. So as they're doing Masayib, we're doing Masayib in Maqtal here, so that we can all finish together and everybody can go recite and, recite poetry and do Matam and Latmiyah together. So what we're going to try to start with as far as the ahkam is concerned is that first point that we need to understand. When we look at these rules that a Shia has to follow, the first thing, if you open up any book of law for a Shia, whether it's the book of Sayyid Sistani or Sayyid Khamenei or any of our marajih, the first thing that they're going to tell you is laws are broken down into two parts. There's the ahkam that we all have to learn, and then there's another part, which is again the usul. So when it comes to the usul, you can't do taqlid. Taqlid means you can't follow somebody else in what they're saying. So if your dad tells you, believe in one God, you can't technically follow him. You have to believe in it yourself. And again, some of us are young here, so you know we're still in the process of learning, and that's okay. So that's why we go to elders and we ask them, you know, give me information, I have some questions. And you should always be asking your parents, or anytime you know the knowledgeable people come to your centers, the ulama, the mulanas come, ask them your questions. Because there's going to be certain things that your mom and dad can't answer. So, with the usul, again, concerning those, we need to make sure that we all have an understanding that we are personally accountable to Allah for those. So we need to have our own belief in the usul. You can't say, well, because my mom and dad say that there's 12 imams, I'm going to believe in 12 imams. All of these things you have to personally believe in. And you might even find later in life that there's certain things you might disagree with your parents about. And that's okay. But as long as you have your proof. Because being a Shia, unlike other faiths, everything that we have comes with burhan. It comes with evidence. We don't just wildly believe in anything. We have proofs for every single belief in the Shia faith. You know, in other schools of thought, you know, they believe in things that you can't understand with your brain. But in the Shia school of thought, if you look at our first book, for example, a hadith book in Usul al-Kafi by Shaykh Qulayni, rahmatullah alayh, the first book that he has is the book of knowledge and ignorance, throughout reason. So our faith is built up on reason, on intelligence, on using your brain, on aql. So we need to learn as Shia how to use this properly. So inshallah, we'll, again, the topic of the discussions will go through the usul. And if we can't answer them in the lecture itself, then again, come to me afterwards and we'll try to address them either afterwards or the next night. But we want to move on to the first part of the ahkam. So once a person believes in Allah, he believes in the prophets, in the imams, in the Quran, in the last day, then his next duty is to figure out, what do I do now? I believe in all of this, how do I practice Allah's laws? So Anytime we learn something, we have to go to an expert. And this is what's known as taqlid. Taqlid is when you consult somebody who knows better than you do. All these maraji, they've been studying for years and years and years. Their whole life is spent on researching, on figuring out how many rakats is this, or what do we do when there's a doubt in prayer, or what do you do if you forgot to, or if you by accident you ate when you were fasting. So all these laws, the maraji have answered and they put in these books. So now, we all have a choice. Whenever we have a question, there's only three solutions. One solution is that we become an expert ourselves. And that means we become a mujtahid. A mujtahid is somebody who goes, he studies in the hawzas, whether it's in Najaf or Qum or Sham or any of these places. He goes and he spends his life, sometimes 10, 15, 20 years, studying the Qur'an, studying the hadith, studying all of this so that he can go to the Qur'an, he can go to the life of the Prophet, and he can figure out what all the rules are. And if he does that, then he can figure out the rules for himself and he doesn't need to ask anybody else. But that's one possibility. If you're, and most of us can't do that because it takes a lot of time and effort. So if we can't do that, there's another option. The next option is ihtiyat. Ihtiyat means is you're not an expert and you can't derive your own laws. So what you'll do is you're going to look through all the laws that have basically ever been written and you'll try to find the hardest one to practice. So for example, let's say there are some scholars, mujtahideen, that say you can't play chess, it's haram. And there's some scholars that say, no, you can, it's okay. Somebody who practices ihtiyat would stay away from it because there's one person who says it's haram. Or for example, let's say that there's one scholar who says, if you travel so-and-so amount of distance, your prayer will be qasr. And then there's another scholar who says, at that distance, your prayer is not qasr, you have to pray full. If you're a person who practices ihtiyat, you have to do both. You need to do the full prayer plus the qasr prayer. So ihtiyat is sometimes even more difficult because technically you need to be a mujtahid, you need to know what all the laws are, and you need to be at a position where you could do the hardest thing which is available. So it's not the easiest thing to do. So then we have a third option. And this is the option that most of us will follow. And this is to become a muqallid. Muqallid is someone who does taqlid. And taqlid just means imitating. It means that we go to somebody who's an expert in law, again like the maraji, and we ask them, what is your answer to these issues? What do I do in the situation that I forget what rakat I'm in? What do I do in the situation where I ate something by accident while I'm fasting? All of these questions we can't answer, that we're because we're not mujtahids and we can't practice ihtiyat. Then we ask the marja, we become his muqallid, and we follow him. And inshallah, we're going to try to get deeper into that in the later discussions and to try to figure out how do we identify who is that person who has the most knowledge. Because obviously, if you're going to go to somebody who's an expert, you need to go to the most knowledgeable person. You know, if you want to go to a doctor, you want the best doctor. If you're going to a mechanic, you want the best mechanic. So inshallah, maybe in the next night, if we have time inshallah, we'll go through the ways on trying to identify and figure out who's the most knowledgeable person. And once we identify him, how do I follow and get his laws? So inshallah, we're going to try to move on to some history now. If you can send a loud salawat. One more salawat. How are we doing on time?
Okay.
What time should we try to...
Whenever you like.
Because I want to try to end with the Masjid as well.
I think they are about 10-15 minutes away.
10-15 minutes away, okay. Now, I don't know if I can give you 10-15 minutes of history, but we'll try our best, inshallah. So, we're going to, again, we're here to commemorate the tragedy of Karbala, but we need to rewind a little bit. We need to figure out what was the situation in the Islamic Empire before Karbala? What led up to the situation, the environment, where a person like Yazid, how could a person like that become the ruler of the Muslimin? So let's backtrack and go all the way to the beginning. So of course we have the Prophet, he's the ruler of the Muslimin. And as we all know, before the Prophet's departure, he was told by Allah that the successor after you will be Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wassalam. Salawat. And of course, he had told the Muslims on many different occasions. So it wasn't just once at Ghadir, but it was over and over and over again. When he began his mission, throughout the mission, all over the place. There's books of 20 to 50 volumes written about how many times the Prophet had mentioned that this person will be the successor after him. But unfortunately, the Muslims, because they didn't have Iman, They didn't follow Imam alayhi al-Islam. A few did. A few true Shia, a few true people with Imam followed him. But people came along and they stole the divinely appointed right that Imam alayhi al-Islam had for Khilafat. So then we had the first Khalifa after the departure of the Prophet was Abu Bakr. After Abu Bakr's time, then you had Umar. Now during Umar's time, he had, you know, during all these three Khulafa, you had Abu Bakr, then Umar, then Uthman. This was the first time that we had the Muslims actually expanding their empire. You know how sometimes you'll hear people who are, you know, Islamophobes, they're anti-Islam, they will say, well, Islam is only all over the place because it was spread by the sword. Well, the simple point you can give to them is that, look at the life of the Prophet. He's the Sunnah we go to. We don't go to the Sunnah of the first three, we go to the Sunnah of the Prophet. Well, at least all Muslims. So, in the Prophet's time, he had never once expanded the empire. He was invited to Medina, and Mecca he had signed a treaty to come back to. So there was no bloodshed in his time at all. So, the expansion of the Muslim empire happened under Abu Bakr, Umar, and Uthman. So they're the ones who captured places like Iraq, Iran, Sham, Egypt. They're the ones who went out and expanded it. So, it was during the second Khalifa's time, Umar, that Muawiyah, Naramdu alayhi, had become, and he was appointed, the governor of Sham. And then it continued on the time of the third Khalifa. So now, how did each of these individuals come into power? Again, like we had said, the Prophet, by way of commandment from Allah, had appointed Imam Ali al-Islam as a successor. But of course, that position was stolen by Abu Bakr. Abu Bakr, before he departed, had appointed Umar. Before Umar departed, he had said that there was going to be a council of six people, and from these six people, they were going to vote, and after that vote, the next Khalifa would be voted on. So Umar was assassinated, and that council came together, and from that council, basically the vote came down to Imam Ali al-Islam and Uthman. And to break the tie, the person there, Abdurrahman ibn Auf, had said he was trying to lean to give it to the Imam, but this was all superficial. They never really wanted to give it to the Imam. They wanted to keep it within their own family, the Bani Umayyah. And so he had asked Imam Ali al-Islam, said, listen, I'll give you the Khilafah. We'll make you the Khalifa. Under three conditions. You have to follow the Quran, you have to follow the Sunnah, and you have to follow the Sunnah of the Shaykhain. And by Shaykhain, he meant you have to follow the Sunnah of Abu Bakr and Umar. So Imam Ali al-Islam replies, I'll follow the Quran, of course, I'll follow the Sunnah of the Prophet, but I won't be following the Sunnah of Abu Bakr and Umar. So the guy says, okay, no problem. And then he turns and he asks Uthman, will you follow all of that? He says, I'll follow the Quran, I'll follow the Sunnah, and I'll follow the Sunnah of the Prophet, and I'll follow the Sunnah of Abu Bakr and Umar. So that's how Uthman took his position. And unfortunately, I mean, there was always corruption during the time of all three of the Khulafa, Abu Bakr, Umar, and Uthman. But especially during the time of Uthman, there was widespread corruption. And there was something called nepotism. Nepotism means that you hire people to work for you just because they're your family. Because Uthman was part of this clan, Bani Umayyah. So he would appoint all of his people. Muawiyah was his cousin. So he let Muawiyah stay in his position. And under Umar's time, Muawiyah had some power, but not as much as Uthman let him have. So under Uthman's time, Muawiyah basically consolidated all of his power. He took a lot of wealth. And he basically wanted to set up his own Khilafah in Syria, or with greater Syria. So he was a very, very powerful person. He had a lot of wealth, and he had a huge, huge army. So because of all this corruption, the Muslims started to stand up against Uthman. There was a rebellion, and they assassinated Uthman. And finally, the people had realized that we abandoned Imam Ali al-Islam from the beginning. If we had stuck with him, then we wouldn't have run into all these problems with the other guys. So they forced Imam Ali al-Islam this time. Because at first, when they came to him and said, we want you to be the Khalifa now, he had said, no. If I do so, you guys won't handle it. Because I'm going to rule with the Quran, I'm going to rule by the Sunnah of the Prophet, and I'm going to rule with justice. You won't be able to handle my justice. I'm going to fire most of these governors who are there because they're stealing your money. Any of you people who are rich, I'm going to take your money back because you got it illegally, and I'm going to give it to who it belongs to. So if you were a rich person, for example, we have the same concept in the time of the Shah in Iran, the ex-Shah. When he was there, there was many people who got wealthy off of that. So after the fact, the reason that they fought Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayh, the reason they fought him is because the Shah gave this wealth out to all these corrupt people. So obviously this is why we still have some people who are against the movement of Iran, because they lost their wealth during that time. And they're continuously losing their wealth because they can't get it illegally anymore. So anyway, short digression. But so then, of course, they force the Imam to become the leader. So now the Imam is the leader of the Muslim Ummah, and he starts firing all these governors, left and right. All the governors start going because he knows they're corrupt. And he starts returning a lot of the money to those who deserve it. And of course, Muawiyah, being one of those corrupt individuals, he sends him a letter and says, okay, you're fired, somebody else has to be there now. Muawiyah doesn't accept this. Now he uses the excuse that, well, you have to catch the killers of Uthman. Before you do that, you know, we're not going to do anything. And this was, of course, just a simple excuse to trick all the other Muslims. But obviously, in reality, he wanted to be the Khalifa for himself. He didn't care about Uthman. He didn't care about the Muslim. He didn't care about Islam. He doesn't care about the Prophet. All he cares about is power. And through his later speeches, you'll see in his own words that he doesn't care about Islam. So, after Imam Ali alayhi salam sends this letter and Muawiyah rejects, this is when we first have all these different civil wars in Islam. I mean, there were some civil wars during the other the first three Khulafa's time, but the real civil war started against the first Imam. So, of course, first you have one of the wives of the Prophet, Aisha. She engages the Imam in a civil war, and some of the ex-companions of the Prophet had joined him in that, Talha and Zubair, for example, in the Battle of Jamal. And, of course, Imam Ali al-Islam defeats them. And then Muawiyah, again, comes after them, and they have the Battle of Siffin. And the Battle of Siffin was, unfortunately, undecided, because within that battle, there were some people who broke out. The Khawarij caused some trouble in there. And again, I know there's a lot of history I'm going through, and if anybody wants further explanation, we can do it later, but I just need to quickly breeze through this so we can get through the Masail, inshallah. But the Khawarij caused trouble in Imam Ali al-Islam's camp. So with that trouble, Imam Ali al-Islam could no longer fight the battle. So it ended up in a peace treaty or an arbitration. And because it didn't really go anywhere, Imam Ali al-Islam just stuck to being a ruler inside, you know, Makkah, Medina, Iraq, Iran, those areas. And Muawiyah had been controlling what was still known as Syria. So there had been little skirmishes that went on here and there, but it didn't really move forward. Then one of the Khawarij, Ibn Muljam, assassinates Imam Ali alayhi salam. So after and before, of course, the Imam departed, he had nominated his son, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, as his successor. So during that time, now people again realized that there was still this corruption that was happening with Muawiyah. So everybody, even more so than in the time of the first Imam, they pledged all of their support to the second Imam. Even the Khawarij were pledging their support, but they pledged it conditionally. They had said, okay, we'll support you if you fight Muawiyah. Because the Khawarij hated both Muawiyah and the family of the Prophet. But they said, listen, we'll help you. You know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That kind of principle. So they said, we'll help you fight Muawiyah. That's what we'll give you bayat for that reason. So the Imam had three different kinds of supporters. The second Imam, that is. He had the close Shia. He had the Khawarij. And he had these groups of mercenaries, or just regular soldiers, who weren't supporters of the Imam. They're just there for gaining, you know, like the spoils of war, you know, just so they can get rich off of war. So initially the Imam had a lot of soldiers, and he wanted to go to war because Muawiyah was a tyrant. He wrongfully was the leader, or claiming to be the leader. So first he tries to send some letters and advise Muawiyah, listen, you're not supposed to be the leader. Just, you know, repent, do astaghfar, and just give me bayat, and then we'll be okay, no problem. But Muawiyah doesn't listen, and he tries to tell the Imam that I am more qualified, I'm a better politician, I'm stronger, this and that. And of course, the Imam doesn't accept this. He says, listen, I'm Bani Hashim, I come from the line of the Prophet. I'm from that, Ayat al-Tahir came on my family. We are the ones who are rightful over the Khilafah, not you. But of course, Muawiyah doesn't listen to this. So they both start getting their army together. And as they both start moving closer and closer together, this is when Muawiyah starts to employ a lot of his tricks. And his trick, because he had so much money, was that he sends spies, he hires people, he sends bribes and money into the army of the Imam. So at one point, the Imam had about 12,000 supporters versus Muawiyah, which could range from about 30 to 60,000 members in his army. But the Imam wasn't scared at that point. He said, we can take our 12,000 and fight his 60,000. There's no problem with that. So sometimes when we say that, you know, the second imam seems to be the one who didn't fight. It's not true. The imam stood up against Muawiyah. He is ready to go to war, even with nearly one third of the amount of soldiers. But what happened? The spies infiltrate the imam's government. The spies infiltrate his army. Even his high commanders get bought out by Muawiyah's money. And they start changing sides. And they start putting this propaganda inside the imam's army. They start saying, oh, you know that the imam is signing a peace treaty with Muawiyah? So people are like, oh, I didn't know that. So then they said, then Muawiyah sends secret letters to some of those people and says, listen, since there's going to be a peace treaty anyway, just make some money off of it. I'll give you some money and just change sides. So that's what people started to do. And after a while, imam lost 8,000 of his close soldiers. So he went from 12,000 to 4,000, just from bribes and switching sides. So now it's 4,000 versus 60,000. Again, the imam wasn't ready to back down, but the situation now changed. As he started to move closer and closer, then the imam was attacked. Someone tried to assassinate him because there was this propaganda, again, sent that there was going to be a peace treaty between him and Muawiyah. So because of that, the people, the Khawarij, attacked the imam. A person even took an axe and tried to cut the leg of the imam. And, you know, he was badly damaged, unfortunately. They even robbed his tent. They took his janamaz, his prayer mat, and took his tasbih. They took everything from him. Why? Because they thought he was making peace. So these were the kinds of people that were right around the second imam. So it wasn't because the second imam didn't want to fight. He had every intention of wiping out Muawiyah. But again, like we were trying to get across, there were no Shia, there were no Mu'mineen then. These people were easily bought out. Just like we're bought out with Black Friday sales, these Muslims, these so-called Shia, were bought out by Muawiyah. So it's the same case. So time goes on, and the imam has no choice now. Now he has absolutely no support in his army. If he were to fight, he'd be completely wiped out. And it doesn't make sense. And Muawiyah knows this. So what Muawiyah does, because he knows that now he's going to be the leader, he knows that there's going to be a peace treaty, he sends a blank letter, a blank treaty to the imam. He says, listen, I've signed at the bottom, you just put your terms, and we'll be open, and that's it. No problem. So the imam lists some of his terms, and I'm not going to go through all of them, he lists 6 points, but just to give you a few. So the imam saw this. This is the wisdom of the imam. He saw this opportunity that I'm going to make sure that in this treaty, people see that Muawiyah is the one who should not be Khalifa. That he's a liar. He's not a Muslim. So he puts these specific points to expose Muawiyah as the corrupt person that he was. So one point, for example, was that you have to follow, and he was addressing Muawiyah, you must follow the Sunnah of the Prophet, and you have to follow the Quran. And why did he say that? Because obviously Muawiyah wasn't following the Sunnah. Why else would the Imam put it in there? Because if he was following it, then Muawiyah would have crossed it out and said, I'm already doing so. But the Imam put it there for a reason. And Muawiyah had no problem drinking. In his court, he had women dancing in front of him before they had court proceedings. He had singing, he had dancing, he had had music within the majalis. He allowed the cursing from the pulpit. Every Friday khutbah, every scholar who would give him the Jummah khutbah, he had told them that you have to curse the Imam Ali alayhi salam before you start your khutbah. So for years and years and years, as long as Muawiyah was the leader, every khutbah, every person in Syria was hearing a curse on Imam Ali alayhi salam. So this is the way that Muawiyah was putting his stuff out. So Imam Hassan alayhi salam makes the point in that treaty. You have to stop the cursing of Imam Ali alayhi salam in your sermons. So again, if Muawiyah wasn't already doing that, then he would have crossed the point out, but he didn't. So it's him saying that, okay, this point is going on. He had also said, you can't kill the Shia anymore. He also said, you have to leave the family of the Prophet alone. And there's many other points that he went on and discussed. So through these points, again, he's trying to expose that Muawiyah is not someone who is a Muslim. He goes back on his word. He's a liar. And there's one specific point which we'll now get into. And this point was the biggest way that the Imam had exposed Muawiyah to the rest of the people. So this point was that after you cannot nominate anybody. You cannot nominate your son as the Khalifa. The successorship will come to me, meaning Imam Hassan alayhi salam. And if it wasn't him, then it would have to go to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. That was the next. So what happens? As Muawiyah is approaching death, his advisors let him know, okay, it's time for you getting close to death. The best thing for you to do is to nominate Yazid, Abd al-Alayh. And he knows that in that peace treaty, that Muawiyah was not supposed to be, Yazid was not supposed to be the successor. it was specifically in there. But Muawiyah had clearly stated, he had told the Muslims at one time when he was in Kufa, this peace treaty that I signed, it wasn't to be someone who carries out Islam. I'm not here as your Muslim leader. I just did this so I can become the leader of all of you. This peace treaty is under my foot. You know, that's how he felt about what was going on. And people, they couldn't really do anything, unfortunately. They were still being tricked by all his money and his propaganda. But what did he do? He nominated his son Yazid. Now, Yazid became the ruler after Muawiyah passed on. So now all of the governors started getting bayat on the different places for Yazid. So now we come to Medina. This is where we're going to continue the story. So our Imam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, is in Medina with his family. And he's asked to come to visit the governor of Medina at the time, who was Walid ibn Utbah. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam knew that something was going to happen. You know, this Walid would not have called the Imam if it wasn't for something very, very, you know, important. So the Imam knew this, so he asked his youth, you know, the ones who were like his entourage, the close companions. He said, you know, we have to go to this guy's place, stick around me, stay outside. If you hear me raise my voice, come inside with your swords ready, because we're going to have to fight. So the Imam went in there, and there's two people who were there. Walid ibn Utbah and his advisor, Marwan ibn Hakam. So Walid lets him know, he says, Muawiyah has passed away. And Yazid, he's now collecting bayat for Yazid. So then he says, you know, it's time for you to give your bayat. So the Imam, instead of seeing right then and there that no, I'm not going to give my bayat to you, he says that, you know, for somebody like me, if I give it to you in private, it's not going to be enough. So it's better that I give it to you in public. And of course, they understood that, and Walid was like, okay, that makes sense, no problem. So he says, the Imam says, let me go back, you know, and then tomorrow I'll do something in public. So Walid, you know, this was enough for him. But Marwan, he was a little bit smarter than Walid. He said, Walid, if you let Hussein go now without getting bayat from him, then you'll never see him again, and you're going to have to come after and cut him. Force bayat from him or cut his head right now. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam gets up, he said, which, and he screams at them, which of you are man enough to cut my head off? So the Imam wasn't scared of them. And he's showing them that if you guys want to kill the grandson of the Prophet, do it right now. But he knew that Walid was scared to do so. He didn't want to kill the grandson of the Prophet. And Marwan, again, was a coward too, so he wasn't about to do that either. So they let him go. So now the Imam returns to his house, and he advises his family about what's going on. So now all the news starts to spread throughout Medina. Now everybody starts to learn, Muawiyah is done. Now Yazid is getting bayat. And because they know that, you know, Imam Hussein alayhi salam is this honorable personality, people are going to figure out, what is he doing? You know, just like in our community, sometimes there'll be somebody who has, you know, a lot of honor and a lot of knowledge. So sometimes we'll ask him, we'll go to him, all right, what is so-and-so uncle doing? If he does that, we'll follow in his lead. So a lot of people are waiting. Well, what is the grandson of the Prophet going to do? If he gives bayat, then we'll give bayat. If he doesn't, then we won't give bayat. So what's he going to say? So now at this time, the Imam is, you know, he's getting advice from his different family members. And obviously the Imam has ilmul ghaib. He has a different kind of understanding of reality. He knows of events before that they even happen, or some idea of it. But, you know, there has to be this kind of, I don't want to say a show, but he has to go through the motions of letting his people know and allowing them to advise him so that other people could understand what the mission was really about. Because it couldn't be the fact that the Imam could just say, well, I know what's going to happen, let me just go do everything. He needs to let other people have the chance to see what the wisdom is behind his movement. So, now the Imam, he realizes that he's going to have to leave Medina. Because if he doesn't leave, Yazid is going to send his forces and they're going to assassinate him. So he knows that there has to be something that goes on. So, well, what does the Imam do? The Imam then starts to contemplate. He's up all night in prayer. He's trying to figure out what's the best course of action. So now he's realizing that he's going to have to leave Medina, and he's going to have to go somewhere else, because he knows Medina is this holy place. He needs to move to somewhere else so that possibly Yazid won't kill him. So he decides, let me move to Makkah. So when he makes this decision, a few days before, every once in a while he's visiting, or every night he's going to the grave of the Prophet. He's going to the grave of his mother. He's going to the grave of his brother. And he's paying his last respects, because again, he knows that he's about to go on a mission which he's not going to return from. So the Imam, then he moves on to the graves. He spends all night praying next to the head of the grave of his grandfather. And one time, the Imam comes close. He's at the grave of his prophet, of his grandfather. He's praying, he's crying, and he says, Sallallahu alayka ya Rasulullah, ana Hussein ibn Fatima. Salutations be on you, O Prophet of Allah. I am Hussein, son of Fatima. I am your beloved, the child of your beloved. I am your son, whom you have left as your heir, your wasila, among your ummah. O Prophet of Allah, ya Rasulullah, be a witness that these people have deserted me and neglected me while refusing to protect me. This is my complaint to you until I come to your presence. And the Imam continued, and he started reciting more and more prayers, constantly in ruku, constantly in sujood, crying and crying. And at one point, this is a different night that the Imam had gone back to visit the Prophet. He finished his prayers and he makes a dua. He says, Ya Allah, هذا القبر رسولك أنا ابن رسولك. Ya Allah, this is the grave of your Prophet and I am the grandson of your Prophet. You know, you're aware of what has happened to me. Verily, I cherish virtue and righteousness and I abhor, I hate evil. Ya Dhul Jalali wal Ikram, I ask you by the right of this grave and the one who is buried here to bring forth for me that which is approved by you and your Prophet. And the Imam continued to weep near the grave of the Prophet, and then he fell asleep. And then the Imam dreamt, and in his dream the Prophet came to him, his grandfather came to him, surrounded by angels on his left, surrounded by angels on his right, surrounded by angels in front of him, and they all came towards him. And the Prophet came to him, and he pressed the Imam's head to his chest, and he kissed him between his eyes, and he said, Ya Hussein, it is as if I have seen you smeared in blood at the place of grief and trials. And a group from among my ummah will cut your head off. And you are thirsty while they don't quench your thirst. And in spite of this, they desire my intercession on the Day of Judgment. May Allah keep them away from my shafa'ah. Ya Hussein!
Ya Hussein!
Ya Hussein!
Ya Hussein!
Ya Hussein!
Ya Hussein!
The presence of the Prophet, when they were kids, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, alayhi salam, it was Eid, and on this Eid, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein were sad, and they came to the Prophet, they said, Ya Rasulullah, all the other kids, they're dressed in nice clothes, we don't have anything. So they asked the Prophet, why don't we have any nice clothes? So then the Prophet started crying. He said, why don't my grandchildren, why don't the youth, the leaders of the youth of paradise have anything? So Jibreel came down and Jibreel said, Ya Rasulullah, why are you crying? And he had told Jibreel, my sons, my grandsons, the leaders of paradise don't have anything to wear on this day of Eid. And he said, don't stop crying, Ya Rasulullah, I'll give you these beautiful robes. So he gave him these two white robes. And he gave him these white robes and he presented them to the Imams. And the Imam said, but Ya Rasulullah, other kids are wearing clothes of nice colors. What about our colors? So the Prophet again said, Ya Jibreel, what can we do? So then Jibreel said, no problem, Rasulullah. I'll pour water over these clothes and you just wring them. And as you're wringing them, ask your grandchildren what color they want. So as he poured water over the clothes, he asks Imam Hassan alayhi salam, Ya Hassan, what color do you want? And the Imam says, Ya Jaddi, I want green. I want a green color. So the Imam rubs that robe and he gives him a green robe. And then he asks Hussein, Ya Hussein, what color do you want? He says, I want a red robe. So he rings that one and he gives him a red robe. And then Jibreel starts crying. He says, why are you crying, Jibreel? He says, tell me why you're crying. And Jibreel says, don't you know what's going to happen to these two Imams? Don't you know that the Imam, Imam Hassan, will be poisoned and his body will be so green, his body will be like an emerald because of the poison that he'll be given. And he says, what about Hussein? And he said, Hussein's head will be cut off and his body will be smeared with blood. This is why I cry for Hussein. This is why I cry for Hassan. Ya Rasulullah. وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيُّ مُنْقَلَبٍ يَنْقَلِبُوا عَلَى لَعْنَةُ اللَّهِ عَلَى قَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. مَعْتِمَ حُسَيْنَ.